Welcome to the 11th episode of Pints of Football. And Himanshu, I'm still hungover from the Champions League action that just went by. As predicted, a slobber knocker of a game between Manchester City and Real Madrid at the Santiago Bernabeu. And then a highly heated Milan derby, which turned out to be a one-sided affair. But football of the highest quality. And I can't wait to break it all down with you. Apart from the Champions League, we'll also discuss a top four race, which until a couple of weeks back seemed to be completely over, has now suddenly come alive with Liverpool breathing down Manchester United neck.
I always said it's still open. That's the pessimistic United fan inside me, but yeah.
What was your favorite catchphrase?
It remains to be seen.
It remains to be seen, Himanshu. Let's not be overly pessimistic about all of this. But yeah, let's straight away go into what was the biggest game of the week that has gone by, and a game we broke down in extensive detail last time. Real Madrid versus Manchester City, the first leg of the Champions League semi-final. Second year in a running that these two teams met each other. The game ended 1-1. It had everything, football of the highest quality, a lot of tactical battles up and down the pitch, both teams having very little margin for error. But at a broad level, Himanshu, which team would be more happy with the result?
Before I get into that, a big shout out to the Pints of Football for getting 90% of whatever we said would happen in the Man City Real Madrid game. So kudos to us. In terms of who would be happier with the result, I think just because it was at the Bernabeu, maybe Man City would be happier because it's a 1-1 draw. Of course, the away goals rule does not exist anymore. So it's just a entirely new game they have to play at the Etihad. But then going back to Etihad, where Man City have been in scintillating form this season, I think they will be happier with the result. Also, having said that, they were trailing for most of the game. So with that point in view, maybe Pep will be happier, although he will pretend in his interviews and his expressions throughout the game that he expected much more from the team.
I mean, I agree with you that Manchester City did seem to be the happier team with the result. I think even before the Champions League semi-final kicked off, Pep had given an interview where he said that this tie will be decided in Manchester, and then Jack Grealish gave that interview that we are going to have the upper hand in Manchester. So clearly City were the happier team. But, and here's the but, because with Real Madrid in the Champions League, there is always a but. Against any other team at the Etihad, I would have picked City to be the favourites. I would have said this is a perfect strategy. But considering it's Real Madrid, and as you mentioned, that the away goals rule has been done away with, I don't really think it matters to this Madrid team. I think what is going to be their key takeaway was they almost walked away with a victory in this game. They were probably, for the most of the first half, they were on the back foot, and still every time they had the ball, they were lethal. And at the end of the day, I don't know what you felt, but I felt attacking-wise, Madrid still hadn't hit all their gears. So I think even Ancelotti would be aware of that. All those Madrid players would be aware of that. So I think even they would be going to the Etihad not worried or not worried that we are playing away from home and it's not going to work out for us. I mean, let's not forget, this is the Madrid team which beat Chelsea last year at Stamford Bridge. I mean, this year also they did it, but this year not that big of a feat. But they also defeated Liverpool at Anfield. So I don't think they will be bothered about playing at the Etihad. So yeah, I mean, and in a long way, I agree with you, but still with a caveat that it's Real Madrid and I don't think it really matters to them. How did you think Manchester City approached this game? Because I think we have a certain difference in our opinion on this point.
Yeah, I think for me, Man City played this game as they play most of their games. They had a double pivot in Gundogan and Rodri, where Gundogan has a little bit more freedom going up front and joining Haaland in attack as like a second striker. But this was very apparently seen in the last game that they played in the Premier League, and maybe Real Madrid were ready for it. I could see in positions where, you know, Haaland would probably isolate Alaba, then Rudiger would take on Gundogan or vice versa. So this was happening way too often. City maybe became a little too predictable in this way. Also, small run-ins as predicted by the great pundits of Pints of Football, Grealish versus Carvajal. We predicted that it's a traditional winger against a traditional right back. It kind of neutralized itself, and Grealish was doing a lot of like non-footballing things there, groaning and moaning at referees and fighting with Real Madrid players. So it kind of worked that they neutralized Grealish, who had turned out to be a very key player for Man City up until now. So that's how Man City approached this game. How did Real Madrid approach this game, Ayusha?
I think with Madrid, for the longest time, right, I've been trying to categorize the kind of football that Real Madrid play in the Champions League. Because even during their era where they won it 4 times in 5 years, it's not like they dominated every game end to end. And especially with this team, there are very obvious and glaring weaknesses that anybody who plays Real Madrid is aware of, but for some reason or the other is not just able to blow apart this team. And the brand of football, or the branding I have put on Madrid's football, it's precision-based football. That's entirely this team is about. They don't play the occasion, they play the moments of every game, right? And that's where I think precision that's why I call it precision football, because whatever they do, they maximize it. If they are defending, then they completely compress that space between midfield and defense. For example, even in this game, right? Every time City were moving into Madrid's half, Toni Kroos was dropping back and Madrid were playing in the 5-4-1 formation. And when they were going forward, they were shifting to a 4-5-1 formation, right? So again, extremely precise in the way they were operating, not trying to be something they are not. 9 players behind the ball when defending, closing out the gap when going forward, ready to expand, right? Secondly, very obvious their threats, that you have to play the long ball out to Vinicius, or you have to, or Benzema would drop back and play the ball out to Vinicius, or sometimes to a Rodrigo again. They did not pretend to do anything else in this game, right? Clearly, they know their strengths. And these players, again, are so well at doing that. Even City knew that Madrid would be doing this, but every time they managed to find Benzema or they managed to find Vinicius. Again, the third part of it, the long ball to Vinicius, and knowing that Vinicius is going to run at you. Everybody knew that. Walker knew that. Camavinga knew that. But every time Vinicius had the ball, he was able to do that. And again, then, and the last part of it is whenever they had, if they would win the possession, then Madrid could also keep the ball. And that's where I think last week when I was afraid, right, that if he plays Toni Kroos, they would be run over in midfield. But Ancelotti again backed his team's strength, right, with Kroos. That's why they were defending in a 5-4-1, because he knew Kroos would not be able to cover ground to drop back. So might as well drop completely deep and use Kroos when Madrid actually have the ball. And that's why every time they were able to beat the Manchester City press so quickly. And again, whenever they got the ball and they played the ball forward, they were going up. Every cross, right, was going into the box, was in a lethal position. Not like Chelsea and United players where there would be lame crosses which would be cleared by the first man. So basically, doing everything with high accuracy is what this Madrid team is all about. And that's why I call them precision-based football. And that is all they did in their game, in this game. They knew what City were going to do, but they played to their strengths. And they waited for the moment where they could showcase their strengths. A long winding answer, but I think Madrid played this game perfectly, absolutely perfectly.
I agree. It's just having these Galacticos who are amazing individual performers and just getting them together, relying on their strengths to deliver results in games. That's what Real Madrid has been for the last decade. And that's what they did in this game as well. So we did identify a couple of key battles that were supposed to happen in this game. And let's see the results of them. First up, Rudiger, as we predicted, might happen to have go ahead against Haaland as against Eder Militao. But this one may be a forced one because Militao was unfit. How did that turn out, Aisha?
In terms of physicality, I think they both matched each other. I don't think Rudiger out-muscled Haaland or Haaland out-muscled Rudiger. They were the perfect match. But we really didn't get to see a lot of Haaland in this game in the first place, right? And I think that again comes back to the way City set up for this game. The main theme across this game was, I think Pep wanted to keep as much of the ball, but unlike against Arsenal where he wanted to keep the ball to actually attack, I think in this game he wanted to keep the ball to avoid defeat. And I think that's how he had set up this his team in this game, where keep the ball and do not try to make something happen unless there is a very high chance. There's a very obvious opportunity for you. And that is why we did not see a lot of these long balls going into Haaland or these risky balls coming in, where we could see a proper clash between Rudiger and Haaland, or Haaland was running behind the Madrid defense.
Essentially,
so I don't think City tried to do.
Correct. Essentially, a lot of what EPL teams have done where they've been successful, very rare occasions, of course, against Haaland, is just reduce the number of deliveries to him. So hence, probably we never even saw that Rudiger versus Haaland proper, you know, man-to-man matchup, as we call it. Over to the next one.
The surprising thing, though, actually also was that even at 1-0 down, City were... It almost seemed like they were not being overly eager to score, right? Even at 1-0 down, it seemed like they were trying to minimize damage in this game. And again, as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, maybe it was simply to minimize the damage going into Etihad and then try to make things happen there.
Correct.
But yeah.
Yeah, that's actually pretty much what I felt as well. It's just maybe they all knew deep inside Etihad is somewhere where we can definitely break them down. Let's just hang on to that one goal or, you know, let's just try to squeeze in an equalizer is something that Man City were thinking.
It's amazing how much City are trying to romanticize European nights at the Etihad, where they're yet to have some iconic moments of there. I mean, it's not like it's Anfield or the Camp Nou.
The empty hat, as they call it. Moving on to the next battle, Kyle Walker against Vinicius. So here, Ayusha, what I felt was even, like, I think Kyle Walker was actually pretty good in this game. He didn't outdone by Vinicius, as the highlight we saw from last year's game, right? Where he did that rainbow flick over him. He did try a rainbow flick on over
he
him.
He did succeed this time also.
But
he did succeed, but it
didn't
lead to
a
goal.
Not too devastating.
Yeah.
And of course, the one goal actually that Vinicius did get in the game was not maybe because of Walker. He actually tucked inside. Camavinga made that run. And he was actually able to get space in midfield. Maybe Man City were lacking there with Rodri, Gundogan not tracking back. Essentially, yeah, that happened. So Kyle Walker actually did well this game, preventing Vinicius from playing to his strength in that winger position.
I totally agree with you. I think Walker had a great game. But again, to me, the scary part is that even with Walker having a great game, Vinicius was still managing to beat him a couple of times. So, and that is what, again, you know, sets up the second leg for me so beautifully. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I felt Madrid still had an attacking gear left in them. What if attacking gear truly kicks in? Because Benzema did not also hit his highest levels. With Benzema hitting that highest level and dropping back and linking more with Vinicius, I think Walker can have, again, more problems in the second leg. So I think, yeah, Walker had a great game, but still Vinicius was able to beat him. So I think Walker also has to step up even more in the next game.
Another key battle that we have to mention, Ayusha, is the midfield battle. It was Cruz, Modric and Valverde against De Bruyne, Rodri and Gundogan. So what did we see here?
I genuinely, going into this game, if you told me that Gundogan would have a bad game by his standards, I mean, by all means, he did his defensive duties very well, I would have laughed at you. But I don't think Gundogan had, I didn't think Gundogan had a very good...
Especially since he almost scored a hat-trick in the previous game.
Exactly. I mean, and he was in such great form. I really thought going into this game, he's going to turn things on fire. He's going to be much more of a threat going forward. But none of that happened. I really feel the Real Madrid midfield won this game. And I'll tell you why. Again, defensively, both these teams were pretty much solid. But I think why this Madrid team, I feel the midfield one was, firstly, while defending, that layer of five with Cruz dropping in the defense and then the four midfielders sitting in front, what it did was, it basically blocked all lanes of passing and all lanes of running for the City midfielders. So they could not do anything obvious. And which means the only opportunity left for them was to probably try something risky, play a bit a longer ball or go over the Madrid defense to Haaland, which they, again, nobody tried to do. Maybe that was the instruction from Pep. But pretty much they got neutralized going forward, and especially De Bruyne in this game. Pep not only asked his players to occupy positions, but he also tells them how to move the ball between those positions. Where Ancelotti just asks his players, okay, these are your positions of the pitch. But how you move the ball between those positions, he pretty much leaves to the player. And I think that's the... And maybe you can do that when you have
such
seasoned veterans
players,
and professional
exactly.
players.
I mean, that's not saying that Man City don't have brilliant players, but it's just...
Yeah, but I mean, with Cruz and Modric, you pretty much have generational talents, right?
Right.
I mean, otherwise, can you imagine any other elite team in any era of football playing with players in their mid and late 30s, occupying that those important positions on the pitch as a double pivot? I mean, it's incredible.
Himanshu, I think this tie is clearly set up beautifully for the second leg at the Etihad. Everything is on the line, goes without saying. Now, going into this second leg, what are the changes that each of these teams, you know, should consider making? Firstly, and let's talk about the changes first tactically or the way they approach the game, and then secondly, maybe in terms of changes in the starting lineup. First, let's start with Manchester City. In this game, as I have mentioned 1,000 times, I think Pep went in there to play safe and get a result if possible. He would be very happy with a draw. He seemed happy with a draw. Second leg at the Etihad, how should he? Should he play the normal City way, which is press again with more intensity? And as we have seen lately, the De Bruyne playing right off Erling Haaland, more direct balls into Haaland, a more direct brand of football? Or should he still be cautious and try to just wait this game out and maybe, you know, see how the game evolves before upping up the intensity? How should he go?
I would love for him to really up the intensity from the word go, especially because it's at home. Also, Real Madrid haven't won in the last 4 occasions that they've played at the Empty Hat. So this is a good opportunity for Man City to really go for it. Having said that, I feel even in the interviews that he's given, right, in the press conferences, he seems to be very wary of what Real Madrid brings to this competition, as we've discussed over and over again. And hence, on one side, when I feel he should be aggressive, he probably will take a very similar approach to what he did at the Bernabeu itself, and hope that, you know, Haaland and Kevin De Bruyne can produce that one moment of magic to win the game. I would love to see actually a Mahrez coming on instead of a Bernardo Silva. I know Mahrez is a little bit one-dimensional, but at least it'll make sure that Kamavinga sticks to his position and doesn't have these free runs that he's getting to supplement the Real Madrid attack, which has become dangerous and obviously resulted in the goal that Vinicius Jr. scored. So starting Mahrez might actually make a difference, in my opinion, in place of Bernardo Silva.
I mean, it actually is a very, very tricky decision for Guardiola. I also, just like you, I mean, whether Mahrez starts or Bernardo start, I think I would like City to show greater zeal when they're going forward, play more of those risky balls, and at the same time press with more intensity. I think in this game, a lot of times, if you observe closely, whenever Modric has had the ball, nobody was going to actually, you know, on Luka Modric. People were trying to maybe block the passes in the lanes, but nobody was going on Modric again. You know, more eager to drop back than probably go forward. So I think in this game, City have to probably take the game by the scruff of their neck, because again, if they're simply passing the ball around and waiting for something to happen, Real Madrid are not the team to panic simply because they are on the back foot. So I totally agree with you that City need to up the intensity, and that's also the only way they're going to bring Erling Haaland into the game. They will not find, by simply playing lateral passes, an opportunity magically will not open up for Haaland, because Madrid will not leave those spaces. Neither are they the kind of team who lose the ball on the transition very easily. And when they have the ball, they're very good at keeping. So a very long winding answer to that. But you mentioned a very interesting point about Riyad Mahrez, right? And that brings me back to a larger question about Pep and his starting lineup. Should Pep be making changes to his starting lineup? Obviously, Riyad Mahrez is one of the options. The second option, obviously, again, is the generational British talent, which is Phil Foden. And I keep bringing up Foden because you have also alluded to it earlier. Grealish in this game, in the first leg, offered nothing going forward. And maybe that's what Pep maybe was asking him to keep the ball more. And then one of the interviews, Grealish said that there were two people on me every time when he received the ball. But he should expect that in a big game, right? He will not get open spaces to run behind. So what should Pep do? I understand you want Mahrez instead of Bernardo. But secondly, should he make changes to the starting lineup?
It's just to make sure that there are more opportunities for a Haaland, right? So if for example, neutralizing the creative abilities of Kevin De Bruyne, then he should have another outlet, like from where he gets his service from, which is a Mahrez. So Mahrez, although he's known for his goal scoring, he can provide the odd cross, the odd pass to, you know, make Haaland come into play. And if you play with Phil Foden, what he does is he makes his runs into the channel, doesn't really stick to his wing, which would mean that Haaland can play these one or two passes off him and find that opportunity for a goal. So these will bring in new elements that maybe a team like Real Madrid is not used to and is not expecting. So that's something that they can explore for sure.
And secondly, in this again, I think you are spot on. I think going into this game, we keep saying, you know, Pep overthinks, but I think yeah, this one change maybe, because with Grealish and Bernardo both, I just think it's not as lethal a team. In the Premier League, maybe it's easier to play past some of their opponents, but I think in Champions League, a team like Madrid, again, they're not really bothered by the attacking threat these guys truly pose.
another thing in this game, Pep didn't make any substitutions for 90 minutes. Forget about substitutions. He didn't even ask anybody to warm up for 90 minutes. And considering the bench he has, I mean, amongst all of this, we're also forgetting Julian Alvarez, who again is a generational talent in his own way, scored a goal in the World Cup final, already the World Cup winner. At a broad level, I think Pep, in spite of whatever we are saying, will probably start with the same lineup.
Exactly. And but for the ones that Pines of Football are asking him to overthink, and he probably is not going to do that.
Yeah. But even as substitute, right? It's okay, 60, 70 minutes gone. The game is still in the balance, or maybe it's the score are still level. What should be the change he should be making at 60 minutes or 70 minutes into the game? Should he take off a Bernardo and get on with Mahrez, or should he bring on a Foden, or should it be an Alvarez?
If it's 70...
It's order of substitutions where if right. he needs to make something happen.
Right. If it's 70, 80 minutes, I don't think bringing on Mahrez will make a difference. Mahrez is one of those players who needs to start the game to, you know, to get into the mix of things. He's, in my opinion, at least not an instant impact player.
Not an impact sub, basically.
Yeah. But, of course, then there's Julian Alvarez, right? I mean, he's a great player. He has that poaching instinct about him. He just knows where to be and when to be. And when the ball arrives, he knows how to finish, as they say. So, maybe he is something that they can bring on. Again, he'll be a little bit one-dimensional in terms of the fact that he probably doesn't drop in and, you know, connect with the midfield, etc. That's probably not what Pep likes about him. But then, having said that, he probably won't follow Pep's principles, which makes him a little bit more unpredictable for Real Madrid to understand and defend against. So maybe a Julian Alvarez, in my opinion, would probably be that impact sub.
One observation, and I'm calling you out on this. I have not heard you say Foden even once. This episode or the previous episode. What is it? Is it because he's coming back from injury, or suddenly you rate Foden just below Alvarez and Grealish?
It's just that he's coming back from injury. He probably needs a little bit more game time before he, you know, really gets into the flow of the way Pep plays. Also, I think, of course, like the Premier League game is one good game. I think they're playing against Everton, right?
Away, yeah.
Maybe if he can get in some experience there, that'll come him good. And in my opinion, again, he's probably going to rest most of the squad that played and play them again. So then maybe Foden will get a few minutes against Everton.
Anyway, I think I agree with you on the Mahrez point. Now that you say it, makes a lot of sense. Mahrez is a player who needs time to warm up into the game. So probably if it's an early substitution with half an hour to play, a Mahrez makes sense. But otherwise, my first pick for a substitute, you know, coming on at 70 minutes with 20 minutes or half an hour to play would probably be Phil Foden. And I think Alvarez is the kind of player, I totally again agree with all the qualities that you say Alvarez possesses, but I don't think he's going to bring on an Alvarez until maybe if City are chasing a goal or it goes into extra time and then he needs to inject some energy. I think that's about City. I think Real Madrid have the interesting choice to make. And I think Ancelotti will actually make a change in this game. So in our previous episode, in the run-up, when doing the preview, we had predicted that he would play Tchouaméni in his midfield and the choice will be between Kroos and Modric. It's very obvious he's going to start, but he outfoxed us, he outsmarted us.
That was the only point which we got wrong, but yeah.
Yeah. Ancelotti, there's a reason he's Don Carlo, he's even outthinking us. So it's very obvious he's going to play with Kroos and Modric. I think he's going to start Valverde, goes without saying. The real question now is, does he play Tchouaméni? Or does he play Rodrigo? Because he's playing away from home. And Rodrigo particularly was not very effective in this game. And maybe, and even though Madrid easily rode out, you know, the City wave of dominance in the first half in this game and got a goal, maybe he would want to pack the midfield and avoid that happening to him. Because let's face it, it's not a good place to be, right? When for 30, 40 minutes you are just without the ball. You'll not always get a goal on the break, even though it's Madrid and he trusts his players. So do you think, see this change happening, or does he go unchanged?
This would probably be a throwback to the pre-World Cup squad that he used to set out, where Valverde used to play and Rodrigo used to come on as a sub. So if Valverde, Benzema and Vinicius up front, you'll have Tchouaméni and the two midfield maestros of Kroos and Modric. And then, of course, so that's the major, that's how he used to play. But I think Valverde's attacking abilities, as the season went on, he just got figured out. And then they defended more against him. He had around 7 or 8 goals in the first 10-15 games, and then he trailed off. So maybe for that reason, he may not go back to what he used to do in the beginning of the season. I'll stick to what's mostly worked against Man City, and then maybe be a little bit more clinical.
But that's my question. Did it work? Is my question. That fact that he got a draw, and Rodrigo, you know, particularly wasn't that effective in this game. We didn't see a lot coming from him. So wouldn't he want that extra level of protection?
Right.
And maybe reduce that City threat even more, maybe win the ball higher up and, you know, relieve some of that pressure considering he's away from home.
It's a good point you make. I mean, if that's what he's choosing to do, but it's just that I've not seen them go with a squad like this for quite some time. Hence, I'm a little bit apprehensive on whether he will actually make that happen. He's not, Carlo Ancelotti is not one to experiment a little too much. He doesn't overthink. If something's worked to some extent, he keeps it and, you know, he just like, and he trusts that his players can make a difference where it really matters. So for that reason, I don't think he'll make that change.
I mean, fair point by you, but only thing is, you know, Rodrigo obviously has worked in the past 10-11 games, but I viewed that City game as Rodrigo's audition on the big stage. And I think on that audition, you know, he failed to make an impact. He's very well known to make an impact as a sub. So that's the only reason probably, and the fact that it's away is where I feel, you know, Tchouaméni will come in. Especially we saw Tchouaméni come in and, you know, have an impact on the game. Madrid had more of dominance in the second half. He got that beautiful shot away. So, but yeah, as you say, it remains to be seen. But yeah, I think between the two managers, I still feel, even though it is Pep, Ancelotti is more likely to make a change because it's also what has more logic behind it. But I think it caps off our discussion on this again, second game. Absolutely, I keep saying, cannot wait for Champions League nights, and this game is just poised on knife's edge. With that, Himanshu, we got a lot right about the first leg, but we got a prediction wrong. We said City would win 2-1. In the end, in spite of all their possession, they were lucky to get a goal. Second leg, let's put our money where our mouth is. What's the prediction? Are we changing it? Are we sticking to City? What are we saying?
This one's a little hard.
And.
Yeah.
Will it be done in 90 or will it go to extra time? Because if it goes to penalty, it's obvious Madrid are winning.
I think this might... this is a tough one to call. Just because it's at the Etihad, and if I just stick to my facts and not maybe my gut, I would say probably City will win this one. And I actually think they'll probably win this one even convincingly. So 2-0 or 3-1 to City. City to win by a 2-goal margin would probably be my estimate. Yeah.
I mean, I also somewhat agree with you. The only caveat here is if Madrid get the first goal, I think they're going through. I think Pep seems to be too much on the edge, and I think it's almost like, you know, it's a beautifully built house, but it seems like a glass house. And if there's one crack, everything will fall crumbling down. But yeah, everything, superstition and, you know, gut aside, but cold hard facts, cold hard analysis, I just feel City just have the players and more quality and more intensity to get it done on the night. So even I agree with you, Manchester City probably 2-0. We'll get that late Madrid goal, which gives hope of a comeback. But I think City will see this out. Moving from one Champions League semi-final to the other one, which was equally heated, equally intense. Well, until the game actually kicked off, which was Inter Milan versus AC Milan, the Milan derby, the game which was supposed to restore Italian football to the pantheons of the Champions League. Turned out to be a very one-sided game, as I've said again and again. Inter Milan winning it convincingly, 2-0. Two quick goals in the first half, another goal which hit the post.
AC Milan had
a penalty which was overruled by VAR.
So a lot of drama in this game, less football, I would say.
But Himanshu, AC Milan just didn't turn up on the night, did they?
Yeah, I think a crucial player that they were missing and was very well publicized was Rafael Leao. He really brings in the creativity within this very aging squad that they have, at least in the front lineup. So he was missing.
Was that a dig at Giroud?
That was a dig at Ibrahimovic as well.
Good, nobody can take a dig at Giroud.
But yeah, so it just felt like they were missing that one clinical person up front who could create that little bit of a magic, especially against an Inter defense, which is really, really good, which really has a way to kind of bore matches into death. So I think that's pretty much what happened. They had two early goals, slightly lucky to concede. I think AC Milan lost their focus. Fikayo Tomori, who has been always told that he should be playing in ahead of Maguire, is someone who did really badly this game and conceded two cheap goals. So yeah, that's, I think, Gareth Southgate vindicated to not select him over Maguire.
And talking about aging strikers, your dig at Giroud, the other senior citizen, Edin Dzeko, scored a goal here, a beautiful goal where he held off his marker and
you know, almost kind of volleyed the ball into the net. And again, a big call, right, by Inzaghi to start him ahead of Lukaku.
Very underrated from the beginning. Even when he played with Man City, he was a very big threat up front. So it's good for Zeko. And also a shout out to three United players who represented, who actually didn't even make the squad in the Europa League finals when it came, right? It was, I think, yeah, it was Lukaku, it was Darmian and Mkhitaryan. Three United legends in their own rights who are now at the brink of a Champions League final. So they've come from pretty low, I would say.
Great things happen to you when you leave Manchester United. I think that's the key takeaway from all of this, isn't it?
Yeah. Or if Giroud scores a hat-trick, then great things happen when you leave Chelsea.
He did win a Champions League with Chelsea, so let's see if... And with Milan, he's not reaching the final, so that statement is not true. But aside from this game, it's pretty much done, right? We don't expect an AC Milan comeback in the second leg. Inter Milan team will at least score a goal.
Yeah, in this season, I think Inter Milan have had the better of AC Milan. Having said that, it is a Milan derby. Anything would happen.
Remains to be seen.
Yeah, this I would probably leave it to my remains to be seen. I really, anything can happen. This is essentially a repeat of what happened in the Champions League semi-final, I think, in 2004-2005, when, you know, they went, like, Liverpool won that Champions League final famously in Istanbul. Very similar circumstances, but of course, yeah, that match was abandoned because there was a flare thrown at the goalkeeper, Dida, AC Milan's goalkeeper, and the match was awarded to AC Milan for that reason. So anything could happen. It is, after all, a Milan derby. So hopefully the derby effect will take place and give something exciting for neutrals like us to watch.
And we both have been to the Milan stadium, right? The San Siro. So it somehow feels special to see this game on TV. Just had to put that out there,
we're very European travellers.
Yes. But aside, coming on to Rafael Leao, outside the Champions League, big news for AC Milan, right? That he's now signed a 5-year contract with them. It was very crucial for, considering all the interest in him, it was very important for them to lock him down to a long-term contract.
Yeah, it's a big success for having him tied down. But I think I've spoken to you about this before. It's just that Rafael Leao, for some reason, gives me a lot of these Nani vibes, right? He can be exceptional on his day, but consistency is something which, I hate to use this term, but remains to be seen. If he can do the same thing he's done this season for the next 2 to 3 seasons, maybe even a shout out for a Ballon d'Or, right? That's something Rafael Leao is really capable of. So let's see what happens.
I think with Leao, I don't know if you're aware of it, right? But there's a very interesting reason also why he agreed to sign a 5-year contract with AC Milan. And that's because
Tottenham were interested in him.
I think that would have shown how wrong things could go in life. But basically, I don't know, for our listeners also, he was originally playing for Sporting Lisbon, right? But what happened was there was an incident at Sporting Lisbon. I don't remember if it's 2018 or 2019, where the fans stormed the Sporting Lisbon dressing room and attacked the players because they were not happy with the team's performance. So as a result, a bunch of Sporting players terminated their contracts themselves with Sporting, stating that they were in an unsafe work environment, and declared themselves as free agent. As a result, Rafael Leao ended up signing for Lille, and then AC Milan bought him from Lille. Now Benfica have gone back to the courts, and now Sporting Lisbon have gone back to the courts and have claimed that these players were actually their assets and therefore they received compensation. With the result that there's almost, and now they're claiming that Rafael Leao's worth at the time he left the club was close to 20 million in the market. And it's no longer clear who's going to pay this 20 million, because anything can happen, the court verdict is pending. And so as of now, that amount is owed by Rafael Leao and Lille. So whichever club who was bidding for him, apart from the astronomical sum they would have had to pay, would also probably had to settle this case and pay an additional 20 million. So that further, you know, kind of restricted the market for him. And I think that's why he's also now decided to stay at Milan with the higher wages. Probably the only club who would take him with so much legal baggage. And I'm sure if the day this gets squashed, the suitors will be back, assuming he keeps his form up. That was our Champions League ramp up. Our predictions, Manchester City to go through, extremely cagey and tough game, and then Inter Milan, nothing is going to stop them. We're rounding this podcast off with a top 4 race, which until 2 episodes back or 2 weeks back seemed settled, and now has suddenly come alive between Manchester United, who have honestly dug their own grave and might be masters of their own demise, and the resurgent Liverpool, powered by Trent Alexander-Arnold, the new midfield maestro. As things stand now in the Premier League between United and Liverpool, United have played 34 games and are on 63 points, while Liverpool have played 35 games and are on 62 points. Liverpool have been on a tear, they are on a 6-game winning streak, while Manchester United have lost their last two games against West Ham and that dramatic last minute goal in Fergie time by McAllister when they went down to Brighton. And frankly now, Himanshu, anything can literally happen. Even the United have a game in hand. Liverpool have sprung to life. There were games they won in a crazy manner. 4-3 against Tottenham. Then they banked 6 past Leeds. And then when push came to shove, they won the past 2 goals, 1-0 by goals from Mohamed Salah. They seem to be capable of doing everything right now. Basically, they found their form at the right time. And United seem to be faltering at the wrong time. How do you see this playing out, especially considering you're a United fan?
I have always said, you can even rewind back to some of our previous episodes, I have been pessimistic. That is my nature as a United fan. I just knew some things might go wrong just because we're in so many competitions at this part of the season. And it's really been a long season for us.
Were in so many competitions.
Right. I mean, and if you look at Liverpool's side, like for example, Luis Diaz, right? He's been missing since forever. Now he's coming back. And then there's Rashford on our side, who is now facing a battle to be fit for the Wolves game. So it just seems like everything is going and working for Liverpool as against United. But injuries apart as well, Liverpool have found a lot of form, especially attributed to something that was spoken out extensively, is like Trent moving into the midfield position. Check out the Instagram post as well as our previous podcast where we've spoken about this extensively. So that's worked out for them. That one weakness behind the fullbacks, at least partly he has fixed moving Trent into that position. But for us as United, I just feel every single match, it's a bit of a, he's just trying to find solutions to the game. It's not really playing cohesively. It just feels like he's finding solutions within the game. It's always a plan B, plan C. And that's not how you secure top four position. Even though on paper it looks like we still have enough number of games and it's still within our control to maintain the top four position, I feel like this might all fall apart very soon.
Because it does seem difficult, right, to think that United would win all four of their games. And I'll read out the fixtures, right? The next game is against Wolves at Old Trafford.
And we have never had a good record against Wolves. It's always, when we have won, it's been 1-0.
But I think this is the version of Wolves you'd want to play, right? They also have not been in particularly good form.
No, they've always been on really bad form and we've still never won against them. I'm going to be pessimistic. This will be a drab draw or a 1-0 for us, maybe.
A drab draw is something United cannot afford right now. Or actually, you can rather afford only one draw, maybe, because if Liverpool win the rest of their games. After Wolves, you are travelling away to Bournemouth. I think that's a good game to play. Bournemouth have seemed to now avoided relegation. So maybe they won't have as much skin in the game. But after that, your second last game of the season, you are travelling, or rather you are at Old Trafford to Chelsea, which will not be a troublesome game at all, given Chelsea's form.
Insert laugh track here.
And then the last game of the season will be tricky because it's at Old Trafford, but it's against Fulham, who are having the season of their lives. So not a particularly easy fixture list.
To be honest, I'm sure the one match I'm afraid of in this list is, of course, the one against Wolves that I just mentioned, and also the Bournemouth away game. Away is somewhere we've really lacked in, the season has been really lacking for away games. And if you think about the season under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we had a record number of games where we were without a loss in away fixtures. So compared to that, we have actually fallen way down in the records, at least for this. So Bournemouth game is actually what I'm really afraid of. The other Old Trafford game, somehow it just seems the crowd will get something out of the United team to get that one goal ahead.
Moving on to the Liverpool fixtures though, right? Liverpool next game are travelling away to Leicester City, which, I mean, Leicester have everything to play for, it goes without saying, otherwise they are facing relegation. But at the same time, they don't seem to be a team which is able to defend at all right now. So I think Liverpool are going to win this game.
Exactly. They might even actually end up thrashing Leicester City and sending them right now,
which will be a sad thing. After that, they're playing Aston Villa, which is going to be a very, very tricky game. And I think if there's one game where Liverpool can drop points, it's going to be against Unai Emery's men, who have also been under great form, right?
Correct. I mean, it is at Anfield, as they say, but Of course, if you look at these three games, one against Southampton, who will probably be relegated by the time Liverpool face them.
Exactly.
And then there's Aston Villa at home. So Aston Villa will put up some sort of a fight. And then there's Leicester City at away, but then Leicester do have a lot to fight for, but just the way they're playing and Luis Diaz, etc. coming back, I think they have no chance against Liverpool.
I think the good thing for United is, in these four games, they can afford to lose one game, but they'll still be in the hunt. The only thing is, if it comes down to goal difference, those costly defeats that you had to Liverpool, the 7-0 will be very costly because United have a terrible goal difference compared to the Liverpool.
And do you imagine after all this, De Gea might actually win the Golden Glove? It's hilarious.
Okay, so tell me right now. Prediction, who do you think is going to finish top four between these two teams?
I'll just have to stick to facts and forget about what relevance I have
pessimism.
For United. No, it's only pure facts. It's the momentum. I really think Liverpool might actually go and get this one. Might drop out.
Okay, so I think I'm going to stick with my original prediction that Manchester United will round off the top four. And I know we are not talking about Newcastle because they are also not far off from Liverpool, right? I mean, if Newcastle lose one game, they will also be in a very, very tricky spot. But yes, I think United will pull it off simply because they don't have to win 4 out of 4. They can afford to lose one game. There is some margin for error. And I think when you lose or draw that game, I think it's going to provide the necessary kick which is needed for this team to, you know, come back to a form. I just want to highlight Newcastle, you know, before we round all of this off. They were also in a very great position a couple of weeks back, but they also seem to have now dropped points. The next game is against Leeds, who have everything to play for. It's away, it's at Elland Road. Then they have a tough fixture against Brighton, which is at home. I know they are a force at home, but they did lose to Arsenal, and Brighton will not be an easy fixture. After that, they are again at home to Leicester City, and then they are playing Chelsea away at Stamford Bridge. Again, Leicester and Chelsea might be easy games, but Newcastle particularly do not have an easy fixture list, right? So between these three teams, United, Liverpool, and Newcastle, I think Liverpool seem to have the easiest fixture list. They seem to have the momentum. And I won't be surprised, you know, that it's not United who drop out of the top four. But Newcastle don't end up being that team.
Oh, so you're saying United will go through, but Newcastle might drop out. That's,
yeah, I mean, I totally see that happening. Because, you know, Newcastle have been in a vein of form, in a great vein of form. But the fixture list, it's just not easy.
Correct. It's just St. James Park. I just, for that reason, right? Because they had good form, even though they lost to Arsenal very recently. I think might just get them over the line. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
I think 2 episodes from now, I think this top four race, it's entirely possible things would have gone crazy.
Yeah, this
will
probably go to the last game. Yeah, for sure.
I think both Newcastle United and Manchester United, both the Uniteds, I think really made this unnecessarily difficult for themselves.
Correct. I mean, they had easier fixtures, but yeah, it is what it is.
To round off this episode, on the note of Manchester United, we'll come back to the ownership question in some later episode.
Yeah, I refuse to take their questions. Extremely tricky, and you want to fit in that in this long episode. So I said no.
No, but when we began this podcast, right, we began it with Manchester United. And my question to you was very simple. What would be a success for United? And at that point of time, you said probably a cup.
And a Champions League qualification.
A Champions League qualification, right.
We're 50% there.
So you have the Carling Cup. You went out of the Champions League. We've covered it before. Dug your own grave. If you finish 5th here, right, considering where the club was last season, where how you began this season, how would you rate? Would you consider this season a success? And I know you wanted Champions League, but still 5th, right? Would you consider it a success considering the togetherness of the club, the solidity, the solidarity, you know, at the club, and the control which Erik ten Hag seems to have over the players?
So when you put it in that context, it would seem like they did okay. But then again, it's Manchester United. The amount of money they spent on players coming in, Casemiro, Anthony, etc. They expected to at least finish top four, right? And if that doesn't happen, then it's a huge disappointment, especially because I'm not sure where the funds will be next season. With whatever funds they will have, will they be able to then attract players to play in the Europa League? It's not going to be a success for me.
And especially, I think if Newcastle end up getting the Champions League, they already seem to have the money.
Right.
And with the Champions League in bag, it'll be easier for them to attract...
Project Mbappe.
Exactly. Like not Project Mbappe, but be able to attract players. Because they will be more likely to buy into the Newcastle project, especially with the allure of Champions League qualification being there. And actually, okay, last question again. I know I keep having a lot of last questions. What about Liverpool? They were nowhere. At one point of time, they were probably looking at making it, you know, to the Conference League. But now suddenly they are at the brink of Champions League qualification. How would you cap off Liverpool's season? Obviously, if they finish in the Champions League, it's a miraculous comeback. But if they finish fifth, how would you read their season?
I think for them, it's very disappointing. If they finish fifth, it's a big disappointment. Because, of course, it's just like how much we expected to them for them to do this season, right? I really thought they'd be up in the number one, number two spots, like vying for the championship. But if that's not happening and they finish fifth, it's going to be a big disappointment. To be honest, even finishing fourth would be a disappointment for them. But considering
considering how the season was going at one point of time, you know, where Klopp didn't seem to have anything in place, a formation,
but now he does now.
Given where they were, you know, yeah. Don't you think it's a great turnaround now? Because obviously at the beginning of the season, fourth would have been disappointing, fifth would have been disappointing, but things seem to be coming back to a point where it seems he has now control over everything. And
yeah, I just feel that one glaring mistake of his fullbacks, right? If he has fixed it earlier in the season, then Liverpool will probably be comfortably in the top four positions. I just wish he had done that a little earlier. Yeah.
Or maybe you wish, you're happy he didn't do it, right?
I'm obviously happy he didn't do it. But in the Liverpool context, if he had done that earlier, it'd be very scary where United would be at this point in time.
Yeah, and even, I mean, that's my point. I think if Liverpool get top four, firstly, Klopp would have salvaged the season. And I think secondly, this would have then been a great learning curve for him, because he would... Next season onward, I think he would make these changes much, much quicker.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, he usually sticks to that one style of playing,
yes.
That high tempo, you know, like traditional way in terms of positional play at least. But now he'll probably think, hey, you know, if I can do these fixes and fix the biggest weakness that we have since we were figured out as a Liverpool team, and
it will be like a new dimension to even Jurgen Klopp.
Correct.
And a new dimension to Klopp would be even more dangerous.
It'll be Pep against Klopp again, if we get bored of Arteta next season.
So there it was, another episode in the bag, a long episode, but we had a lot to talk about, and I think it turned out to be an interesting one. Thanks again for listening to us. Our Instagram page has been gaining a lot of traction, so thank you to everybody who has been engaging with us on Instagram. Do continue engaging with us. We'll also try to post some of our discussions on Twitter going forward. So you can follow both me and Himanshu personally on Twitter. And we'll be back next week with all the fallout, you know, from the Premier League weekend, as well as what's going down in the Champions League. Until then, see you.